Welcome back to World Crisis Radio for our second hour of this week's program. This is Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C., and now an institution on this program since August of 2008, since before the Democratic National Convention made the leap into the abyss by nominating a relatively unknown and undistinguished candidate of dubious qualifications and even eligibility to even run for president. We've been trying to check in with Phil Berg, distinguished lawyer from Philadelphia, and again, former Democratic County Chairman for Montgomery County, Pennsylvania, former member of the Democratic State Committee for Pennsylvania, former Democratic primary candidate for governor and senator from the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Phil Berg. Phil, welcome.
My pleasure. How are you doing today?
It's good to see you again. Now, we want to get our weekly update, so please take it away.
Well, nothing new, much new has happened. I was in court yesterday on the case where Liberia versus Orly Tates, but I just want to say on that, we want to low focus on that, but I really believe that we are the most direct on target, and that's ObamaCrimes.com, ObamaCrimes.com. Unfortunately, I had to sue Orly Tates because she has been disseminating the Social Security number of one of my staff volunteers, and it's against the law. And I don't know. I believe that Orly Tates' intentions are detrimental to the cause. But I'd rather talk about the three cases I have.
Phil, before we go on, though, she must give some explanation. Why does she harass you? Why does she harass you in her own terms? What does she say about this?
She's just saying that this person is no good, and therefore we should look at all the records. There's no legitimate purpose for what she's doing. She's trying to bring me down, which makes no sense. Anyone trying to bring me down has to be tied for, and I think she's tied into Obama. I think she must be working for Obama or someone for him, because if we look back at what she has done or not done in the past 7 months, I believe everything's detrimental to the cause. Remember what we have to do here. In my opinion, we have to raise the public awareness. And now I'd say, you know, I've guesstimate that we're up from 10 to 15 to 20 million people maybe know about what's going on. But we have to raise that to 75 million. And when someone like Orly writes letters to the FBI and CIA and asks them to investigate the U.S. Supreme Court, saying that they're playing around with her cases and the clerk of the Supreme Court is doing things wrong, I don't think that attracts new people. You know, new people, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, then they're crazy. But we're not crazy. We're on the point. If you look back, her running all around the country with her quo warranto, asking DAs or attorney generals to file them, that's not the proper procedure, and we're going to get to that soon. I really think that she's hurting the cause. I think that there's ulterior motives back there, and I will not tolerate her doing what she's been doing, and I will pursue that. But I want to be quiet on that. But does it make sense? Does it make sense that I have the three most viable cases pending in the United States federal court system and her wanting to bring me down and bring me down through my assistant? Does that make any sense?
It only makes sense, Phil, if what I believe is that this is some clique of reactionaries, some clique of right-wingers who want to control the debate. In other words, they want to say, well, Obama is a leftist, and anybody who's against him has got to be some kind of a reactionary Republican, and you break the mold. I always stress your background in the Democratic Party, the fact that you're a paid life member of the NAACP, and all the other things that you bring to this. It makes it impossible to say that people who are interested in Obama's birth certificate are somehow KKK or white supremacists or some other collection of lunatics. You break the mold. In other words, you de-ideologize this question and bring it down to reality.
And I'm so glad I am doing it for that purpose, to legitimize it, because it's a very legitimate concern. You know, it would be like some talk show host the other day said, oh, it's nonsense again. Well, it's not nonsense. And think about it. You know, just because 60, 70 million people voted for him doesn't mean anything, because 60 or around 60 million people voted for McCain. But of the eligible voters, an additional 90 million people who could have voted didn't vote for either one. But that means that 90 and 60, 150 million people did not vote for Obama. So it's not overwhelming when he got his 63 to 70 million votes. And what I'm dealing with here is, and someone called me today and said, well, the Constitution's really not being followed. I said, well, it must be followed. That's the basis of our country. That's the foundation document on which our country is based, the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence and the Bill of Rights. And people around the world want to have a country like ours. They want to, you know, that's what they want. So on that basis, you know, we have to hold up this Constitution. And I think Obama is trying to destroy the Constitution, destroy our country. I hate to get into issues here, but when the Tea Party people are getting ready to rally again, they have to look at us, because the basic issue is, if he wasn't in office, he couldn't be doing all this other stuff he's doing to send the country down the drain. And he's, and as far as I'm concerned, 1,000% illegitimate. He is not constitutionally eligible to be president. He's not constitutionally qualified to be president. And some people want to say, oh, what's the difference? Well, there is a difference. And taking the case of I'm an attorney, or take an attorney or a doctor who's been practicing for 15, 20 years. Let's use that. And all of a sudden someone says, that person never passed the bar. That person didn't go to medical school. That person didn't get his medical license. Well, what do they do with that person? They arrest that person. They try that person. That person's a fraud. Well, we have a fraud in the White House. And if I'm wrong, prove me wrong. I've said that all along, you know, Webster, in your show from way back when. Show me your birth certificate. Prove me wrong. You know, but now we want the documentation, not only your birth certificate, but documentation when you came back from Indonesia, and documentation that you retook your allegiance to this country. Documentation shows that you're natural born. And by him spending over $1 million defending these things, fighting these lawsuits, it just shows you don't spend $1 million unless you're hiding something.
Absolutely. Anybody can see that. And
now,
I think also the Constitution, right? The big opposition to Bush and Cheney was they violated the Constitution. Of course, they did. But you can't then say, well, now we're going to pick and choose what part we like and what part we don't like, and that stuff about natural-born citizen is the part we don't like, so we're going to forget that for the next 4 to 8 years or however long this regime lasts.
Then
you're in the realm of anarchy, aren't you?
Absolutely. And people are complaining about what Bush did with the Constitution, but all of a sudden no one's talking about the Constitution. But Obama has to eat his words, because he says his administration will be the most open administration. It will be the most transparent administration. Well, that's baloney, because if you can't even acknowledge that you're qualified to be president, how is it open? How is it, it's not there. It's not transparent, because you're not transparent. And, we have to really stand up. And that's why it's great being on your show, and I hope all your listeners go to their address book and send ObamaCrimes.com to everyone on their address book. I ask them to send it on to everyone on their address book, and on and on and on. Because once we raise the public awareness to like 75 million, we can accomplish something. Remember the Boston Tea Party. Remember we fought for the foundation of this country. Remember there's been civil war. There's been wars over the years to fight to defend our Constitution. And it's up to us now. I don't want a war. I want a peaceful revolution. I want a peaceful revolution to force him to either show that he's qualified or force him out of office. And I believe he should be out of office. And all these laws he's passing, all these bills he's doing and the spending, they're all void or voidable, because he is a usurper. He doesn't have the power. He doesn't have the license to be in office.
Well said, Phil. And I urge everybody to go to your website, ObamaCrimes.com. And keep informed, and above all, give you a contribution to keep this valuable work going. Again, I think it's absolutely critical. Obama is now falling in the polls. I think interest in this can only grow. There's going to be a new wave, I think, of people coming to you. And we hope to see you next week. And have a happy 4th of July in the meantime.
You too. Thank you very much.
Bye-bye.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio, Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C. One aspect of what Phil Berg is saying is the U.S. Constitution is a written Constitution, and that was a big step forward at the time. The British, you'll remember, claimed to have a constitution, and you said to the British, all right, fine, let's see your constitution. Well, it exists as a body of precedents and ways of doing things. Okay, fine. Then there's at least got to be some unofficial compilation of what the British constitution comes down to. Well, no. Why not? Because some of the precedents are secret. Some of them are, you know, star chamber proceedings from the 1500s or the 1600s, and you're not allowed to know them. They're covered by the Official Secrets Act. So you've got secret constitutional precedents ruling what goes on. The only alternative to that is a written constitution where you can see what's what out in the light of day. And that, of course, means then that if there are parts of the written constitution that you don't like, right? How about the part about people not being able to accept titles of nobility from foreign governments and still serve the United States in offices of trust and profit, right? That was the one that a lot of people came close to violating when they talked about putting Sir Colin Powell in the White House or any of these other guys, Sir Brent Scowcroft, Sir Henry Kissinger, and on and on and on, right? Sir Caspar Weinberger and so forth. They all got their titles after they left government, as far as I know. But if you have somebody today who's got a title of nobility from a foreign government and is serving as a federal official, that's unconstitutional. And there's a reason for this. It's not just some quirky, quaint old thing, right? Quaint was the word given by the Bushmen to the Geneva Convention. Well, too bad. It's illegal. So when you get down to this thing about the natural-born citizen, that's serious. There's a reason. And this the essay from the American thinker by Mrs. Ichinga on Obama as a figment of British post-colonial Africa, this gets a little bit to the core of the matter, right, that we're bringing in a whole worldview which is fundamentally not indigenous here, at least in North America, let's say. And again, I think that's Frantz Fanon is the key to the entire thing. Now, back to cap and trade. Again, this is the Waxman Bill, H.R. 2454. You got to defeat it. You can go to various right-wing or indeed reactionary websites, at least let them do their work. Red State, for example, you can get a list of the fence sitters. There are 8 or 10 Republicans on the fence. There are even more Democrats, too many for me to go through here. But what you ought to do is go to these various websites, find out if your congressman is wavering on this bill and get them to vote against it. This would be a great opportunity to deliver a stinging rebuff to Obama and his entire Malthusian gang, and to Pelosi and the rest of them. This is as important as the fight against the first round of the stimulus, the first round of the bailout, which was the issue back in October of 2008. Remember that big mobilization to try to stop the $700 billion going to the Wall Street banks. Well, this is an attempt to take about $700 billion out of the world of real production so that it can be used for various bailouts coming up in the future. And if you're going to make a call to a congressman, get yourself a twofer. The healthcare situation, we've talked about it over the past couple of weeks, right? I would say there are two things that you want to stress, or maybe three. One is no rationing of care. No telling people they're going to die in order to save the bottom line of some health plan. The only way you can make savings in a national health care program is through a crash program, a Manhattan Project program, to find cures for the various dread diseases. That gives you real savings. That gives you absolute real economic surplus that you can use then for various purposes. So unless they're talking about a crash program to find cures as an integral centerpiece of this entire thing, you're talking about the rationing of care. And that, of course, gets us into the Nuremberg area, high crimes against humanity, or if done on the largest scale, gets into genocide, now against the American people in the name of saving the bottom line. In California, under Schwarzenegger and the dysfunctional legislature in Sacramento. That crisis goes on, and they're talking about basically wiping out state Medicaid as well as welfare payments just in time for the possible return in grand style of the H1N1 swine flu epidemic expected when the cold weather returns to the northern hemisphere, or at least a substantial possibility that that will be there. Conspiracies, of course, are always at work, and I know something about this. But the approach to this has got to be Hill-Burton criteria. We were told in 1946 that we needed 4.5 to 5.5 beds per 1,000 population. We're now down to 3.2. We need 500 to 1,000 hospitals rebuilt. 1,000 hospitals at 500 beds each would give us 500,000 beds. That would basically get us to the lower end of the Hill-Burton criteria, the lower end of what was considered desirable and necessary in 1946, 60-plus years ago, two-thirds of a century in the past. So let's catch up with Hill-Burton and then the crash program. Now, the other side of this is the Republicans obviously fear any government plan. I don't fear the government plan. I think you've got to remember now today that the healthcare is rationed by corporate executives, right? The current situation is the system is deregulated. It's for profit. You can't sue an HMO. Your life depends on it. That's no good. And the HMOs spend money on their executives, their bloated pay packages, their lobbying, their advertising, and above all, dividends. And all of that, every dividend is taken out of the world of healthcare. So fine, we've got the U.S. Postal Service competing with FedEx and UPS. Let a government plan compete with the corporate bureaucrats. Maybe that gives us the chance of playing one group against another. I would always say a government bureaucrat is more susceptible to public pressure than a corporate bureaucrat who's deregulated and you can't sue him. At that point, what can you do? You can boycott the company and appeal to public opinion. But the government official is more vulnerable to public opinion than the corporate one. The other side of this is what Obama is doing, of course, is part of the derivatives bailout. Insurance, okay? As soon as I say insurance, you should be thinking AIG. The biggest insurance company in the world blew up because of what? Because of derivative speculation, the AIG London hedge fund with their $3 trillion of derivatives. And that has cost the taxpayer $180 billion, enough to pay for health care for quite a few years. We now will look at the catalog of other companies in the insurance world that are thought to be on the brink back in a minute.
The GCN Radio Network, providing the world with hard-hitting talk radio. GCN, great talk radio starts here.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. Just talking about the double threat by Obama, cap and trade to strangle production and prop up the speculative market in carbon offsets, a new area of speculation bonanzas for the parasitical Wall Street interests, and then the health care plan, which is in Obama's hands, in the hands of ORSAG and Baucus, is going to be a program of gouging Medicare, Medicaid, and the other programs to make savings that will be used for bigger and better Wall Street bailouts. So that's what happens when you get a Wall Street puppet in the White House calling the shots. Now, again, the idea that private insurance can cover the medical situation, this is not going to be the case. AIG, completely bankrupt, $3 trillion of derivatives. You've paid $180 billion into the coffers of AIG, and that's just the beginning. It'll reach $500 billion unless somebody comes in to stop it, because the derivatives are a black hole. You just can't get rid of them. They can't be unwound. Try unwinding a black hole. Won't work. But that's not the only one. If we look at the catalog of other insurance companies, we will find that The Hartford, a very big one up there in Connecticut, the centerpiece of that entire Connecticut-based insurance racket, The Hartford took $3.5 billion in TARP funds, an unsung story. The TARP funds were offered to Prudential. The most recent word I have on that is Prudential has not accepted them. But they did float a billion and a quarter of stock to water down their existing stock. Allstate was offered TARP. MetLife was offered TARP. Lincoln Financial Ameriprise Financial, Principal Financial, all eligible for TARP funding. I believe most of the rest of these didn't take it, but you get the idea. If AIG is long gone, Hartford obviously long gone, the rest of them on the brink, kept going with various kinds of infusions. If you don't take TARP money, you can borrow from the Federal Reserve at special rates. So you get the idea. The entire private insurance complex is bankrupt. That is why they are willing to accept the Obama plan, because they think that this will keep them going. So what's being done here is to create a state-sponsored compulsory cartel for the purpose, in this case, of denying care and causing sacrifice for the population while the speculative derivative structure is propped up. And as we've said repeatedly, that is the formal definition of the corporate state, the Mussolini fascist corporate state, as it evolved in Italy in the 1920s and the 1930s. So the idea that you get out of this with private insurance only, I think, is not going to be the case. Medicare for all, a good idea. Some kind of government program. But then the question, fight the rationing of care on the one side and fight for the crash program to bring about cures. Now, Obama has thrown General Motors and Chrysler under the bus. You can say that Obama has made Chrysler dependent on fiat money. Obama rules by fiat. He brings in fiat to asset strip the companies that he doesn't include in his state-sponsored compulsory cartels. Obama to California, drop dead. Obama to California, drop dead. Remember the old New York newspaper headline, Ford to City, drop dead. That was 1975, the bankruptcy of New York City. Now it's 2009, California approaching bankruptcy. Obama to California, drop dead. We've got $700 billion for Wall Street, but we don't have $25 to $30 billion for California. This is an absolute scandal. This is Obama. This is the essence of Obamism. This is Geithner. This is Volcker. This is Summers, Orsag, and the rest of them. Orsag, by the way, is promising that after they loot Medicare and Medicaid, they're going to go on to loot Social Security. They want to realize savings in Social Security. They should be increasing Social Security, because for a lot of people, the 401ks will be gone, the IRAs will be gone. The only thing you'll have is a Social Security pension. You better double it so that it actually becomes a living, dignified means for elderly people to live in retirement. And don't touch Medicaid and Medicare either, Orsag. But, of course, Orsag, the pointy-headed bureaucrat and bean counter par excellence, is interested in looting all of that. What are your qualifications, Orsag? You got a degree in public health and medicine. What do you have? No, I'm a bean counter. This guy is the acme of elitism and cruelty. He's someone who does his dirty work from the desk, but dirty work it is nonetheless. So Obama has told California drop dead. A formal request by the state of California to participate in TARP funds has been rejected by Geithner and by Obama. When will people wake up? Hey, you California leftists. Hey, you nurses. Hey, you teachers. Hey, you people out there in California. Take a look at my 9-point program for California. It solves this question with a 1% Tobin tax or securities transfer tax that you can slap on the San Francisco community of financiers up there, the various Wells Fargos and, what is it, Transamerica, that stylized pyramid there in the middle of the San Francisco Financial District. All of those people should be paying a 1% sales tax on all of their speculative turnover, derivatives, stocks, bonds, foreign exchange, commodities, securities, you name it, and derivatives of all kinds. Once again, you could plug the hole in the California deficit right away. You can go on to stop foreclosures for 5 years in California, and you could get the interest rates on credit cards down to 10% with a state usury law. That would be the beginning. Obviously, the real solutions are at the federal level. Now, the Obama regime is showing some cracks. We've got this thing. Obama has fired a number of inspectors general for showing signs of wanting to expose the corruption and the stealing and thievery of the Obama regime. But it's actually broader. It includes questions of policy. We're still working on a thorough factional analysis here. It's probably just the war of all against all, right, in a polycentric oligarchical system. Penny Pritzker, the chairman of Obama's finance committee, has broken with him because Obama gives lip service to the card check for the unions. I think anything that would strengthen the unions would be a good thing. Again, to bring back balance is that we've got a power of corporate evil and some power of perhaps evil incarnated in a trade union. It's better for them to fight each other rather than for one of them to run wild. This is the theory, of course, of Machiavelli in the discourses. Pritzker, anyway, says she doesn't like Barkey's lip service to the card check. She's not happy with Barkey on that score. Michelle Obama has fired her chief of staff and brought in a loyalist from the Valerie Jarrett corrupt daily machine in Chicago. Dennis Ross has been canned as the envoy to Iran, partially because the Iranians wouldn't accept him. They treated him as someone with ties to Israel that were far too well developed for them to trust him. So Dennis Ross out as envoy, special regional envoy to Iran. He will, however, get a post inside the National Security Council. Some say he'll feel more powerful there. You saw Biden and Hillary attacking Obama on Iran. They wanted more bellicose statements, unfortunately, but there it is. You've got the U.S. special envoy to Sudan, a military guy, is attacking Susan Rice, in effect, for this constant blather about genocide in Sudan that Mrs. Rice, Ambassador Rice, is putting forward. This is the new Rice, not the old Rice. Susan Rice, UN Ambassador, constantly attacking Sudan on the genocide argument. Her goal, of course, is to overthrow the government and cut off oil deliveries to China. That's the dirty secret of this. Eric Holder, the corrupt Attorney General, has defended the Defense of Marriage Act. This has caused great estrangement of the gay community against Obama. You've also got the single-payer people who are very unhappy with Obama. Neil Gorofsky and Elizabeth Warren, the two top overseers, unhappy. So a lot of cracks in the regime. Back in a minute.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Remember also that back over there in Iran, Mousavi is the candidate of globalization and free markets. Mousavi wants privatization of the Iranian state sector. So we've got the mantra, deregulation, privatization. The people who support him are the rich elitists of North Tehran. Learn that lesson. Mousavi is the free marketeer. He's the economic reformer. He wants to bring down the state sector and make things worse. So he's got a touch of Austrian school thinking in him, doesn't he? And the opposition to Mousavi is people who say there should be morality in economics. There should be morality applied to economic decisions and not just market fetishism. This is a debate that's gone on in places like Poland and Russia for many, many years. Now, a couple of historical notes now in conclusion. The 2nd of July, take a look in your Farmer's Almanac. You're going to find the Morrill Act, the Land-Grant College Act, passed in 1862, July 2nd, 1862. Justin Morrill, somebody we should remember. In order to be duped by the Austrian school, the precondition is you've got to know nothing about real American history. You've got to know, at most, Milton Friedman's Monetary History of the United States, which is a hallucination undoubtedly assisted by the narcotics that Uncle Milty praised so much during his lifetime. It's not the case that you go back and you find, you know, free markets. No, not with Lincoln, not with Justin Morrill. Morrill has got his name on two important bills. One is the Morrill Tariff of 1862, which means for the first time with the Southern Free Trade Bloc out of the Union, it was possible to pass a protective tariff. And the protective tariff was the great thing about the Republican Party. The thing that made the Republican Party a progressive force in the world from the 1860s into about the time of World War I, but even beyond. I mean, Herbert Hoover, You could say Herbert Hoover stacks up against Franklin D. Roosevelt. Herbert Hoover is better on one point. He wants a protective tariff, and he says so. He says, I want to protect American farmers and workers from sweatshop labor, sweated labor, working on cheap land. We don't want to compete with that. We want to keep our internal market as the exclusive preserve of the American farmer. And that was actually better than the Roosevelt coalition in 1932. It's very narrow, you might say, but it's a very important point. So the protective tariff that's got Marl's name on it is the one of the keystones to preventing British dumping until the end of the 19th century. And making the U.S. this great industrial power. The other side is the land-grant college program, which has to do then with the financing of the Transcontinental Railroad using public land, that is to say, dirigism, protectionism, mercantilism, producerism, and populism, all of the good ingredients of economic thinking. Now, very quickly, we've got this question of the bank holiday. I want to try to address this. It came up in the past couple of days. You've got some newsletters that are talking about a bank holiday, and the idea that there's some plan to have a bank holiday and that U.S. embassies abroad are selling dollars. To cut to the conclusion, I would say selling dollars is not a sign of a bank holiday. It's a sign of a dollar panic. A dollar crisis may be already in the works for all we know. The massive rush to the exits to get out of the dollar before it comes crashing down. It is, therefore, I talked on Russia today about the idea of repatriating dollars. For example, if Russia has 100 billion U.S. dollars, buy 1,000 hospitals, or as close to you can get, to deal with the problem of longevity, the lifespan in Russia and the standards of healthcare in rural Russia or rural China. Both of these countries could well invest huge amounts of money in one of the few things where the U.S. is still a world leader. That would be healthcare and the related technology. Otherwise, you look at the U.S. economy. There's not a whole lot where the U.S. remains a world leader outside at least of the military sphere. There would be, of course, other things that you could buy. But let's look now at the bank holiday. What people do not understand is the Roosevelt bank holiday did not close banks. The banks were already closed. The banks had gone bankrupt quite on their own. This was a consequence of the British default on gold, what most people probably never heard of, but it's the main event of the World Depression of the 1930s, the British default on gold, September 21st, 1931. You can read all about this in Surviving the Cataclysm, Chapter 7, Models of Disintegration. In 1931, we had 2,300 bank failures here in the United States, and after that, it turned into a rolling depression with the Chicago banks in crisis in June of 1932, October 1932, Nevada banking crisis, February 1933, Louisiana banking crisis, despite the efforts of Huey Long to stop this, Michigan banking crisis then, despite the efforts of Henry Ford. The Bank with Hank movement failed, and none of this stuff was able to work. Walter Chrysler, Alfred Sloan of General Motors, and the Hudson Department Stores tried to keep the banks open. It didn't work. You had Wall Street then discredited in the Pecora hearings around this time based on what they were doing in the crash of 1929. The New York Fed was on the verge of defaulting. There was a panic run on the Bank for International Settlements. In the last night of the Hoover administration, Governor Lehman of New York closed the banks in New York. The Illinois bank holiday was then declared a couple of hours later. By the time Hoover left office at noon in March of that year, every bank in the U.S. had shut down. You had a chaotic collapse of the banking system. What the Roosevelt bank holiday did was not really to close any banks, but to make that into an orderly and legal process of triage. Some of the banks had to be closed for good. Others could reopen immediately. The middle group had to be helped. What we learn from this is that in the 1932-33 banking crisis, there was no private sector or free market solution. None. It didn't work. There was no Federal Reserve solution. Rather, the Fed was an accomplice in the collapse and disintegration. This was one of their big strikeouts. No state was ever able to reopen its banks. So forget about state solutions. Congress failed. And the failure of Congress was so obscene, that fascist ideologues started to agitate for the Mussolini model in the United States. That would have been the Morgan Group demanding a new march on Washington. The federal agencies, the Reconstruction Finance Corporation and others, failed to keep any of the banks open. The Hoover cabinet, this is the backwash of Andrew Mellon, liquidate labor, liquidate stocks, liquidate real estate, values will be adjusted, and enterprising people will pick up the wreck from less competent people. Raving insanity. How many have to die in the process? How many lives are going to be ruined in this devil-may-care approach to the lives of working people? Creative destruction. Sure. The biggest failure is the passive presidency of Herbert Hoover, convinced by Mellon and others, in spite of all of his protestations, that he really couldn't do anything to end the Depression. And in the end, therefore, it took an active president, an activist president, Franklin D. Roosevelt, to deal with this. Now, the cause of all this has to do, again, with this British default. Go back, and you can look at this in Surviving the Cataclysm. Lord Keynes, Essays in Persuasion, September 27th, 1931, a few days after the British had defaulted, Keynes said that the British were going to use gold, the fact that the British had gone off the gold standard and the U.S. had stayed on, for purposes of economic warfare against the United States. Competitive devaluations by the British, the Ramsay-MacDonald government. And Keynes writes, on France and the U.S. will fall the curse of Midas, because the exports of France and the U.S. will be so expensive that it's impossible for them to survive economically. So the British, in effect, cast the curse of Midas on the United States, on the French, and on the other members of the gold bloc. So bank holiday would be good. Obama is avoiding a bank holiday. He should declare a bank holiday, shut down J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, Bank of America, and the other top 16, unwind their derivatives. But that's not happening. The whole regime is to avoid that. So I don't see a bank holiday. I see a dollar panic coming sometime in the near future. We'll be back next week. Actually, we won't be back next week. This program will be repeated. So please bear with us. We'll resume the normal programming after that. See you next week, or see you in the coming weeks.